So I think that at a high level, I would say that you don't 100% need a college degree to get into cybersecurity, right? It's not a necessity, right? Just the same way, you know, you don't always need, like, there's specific things you just don't need, right? But it's not also to say that it's not helpful or it's not important. If you're going to go to college route, right, it should be approached with more caution and precision than people put into it.
Yo, man, do you let your parents know how much money you make? Or not even, we don't even just keep it on parents. We'll say parents, family members, friends, girlfriends, you name it. Do you let them know how much you make?
I mean, of all of my family, only my parents know how much I make. I don't even know if my sister knows. But they only know, like, how much I make from, like, working at, you know, Datadog, but like everything else, like content and like other stuff that I do, like they don't really know how much I make from that.
You probably got a couple of raises since starting at Datadog, man. This guy's probably, he probably raking it in by now. Yeah. Besides my girl and like close friends, if I'm talking about like what I'm getting offered salary wise or if I'm negotiating, a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
But granted, now, the good things are some of these companies that are based in New York and California, you got the range on the job description. So you could possibly hypothetically think about what that person's getting paid. But for me, I just don't disclose it just because, one, when people think they know what you make, then they feel like they're entitled to your bread. Sometimes I always want to ask you for stuff when, you know, they're not managing their money correctly. Two, some people get a little jealous or if they know what money you're making, they don't understand the type of moves you're making. Like, for example, when I quit my 175K job, you know, I have a friend that was like, ah, man, for that money, I would do whatever they said. You know what I'm saying? But not knowing that it's more out here than that. But sometimes they can't fathom it. So you have to, like, a lifelong lesson to the listeners and the watchers, or shall I say viewers, is only tell this information to people who have the same mindset as you, who are trying to go to the same places. So they won't help you, but they won't limit what you think about what you can do. And they won't be just to actually be genuinely happy for you. That's kind of one of the things that I went to, is like only telling certain people these things, because they can be like, man, that's good. Cause, you know, like if they tells me, yo, Google just hit me up, they're going to pay me $250 base salary, I'm going to be happy for them. Like, I'm not going to be mad. You know what I'm saying? That just always like, let you know, hey, the money is out there. And then when you're in your negotiations with a big company, you know, other people are making, that's how you can negotiate your worth. But I'll touch on this though, because you brought this up earlier about content and everything else. I think the hardest thing now is there's no union or anything. I don't even say union, but it's so many different us that are content creators. Nobody really knows what to charge. And I'm thinking of banding together a couple of us and just figuring out like what the charge, because some of these companies are reaching out to all of us and then they're paying different things just because we are communicating with each other.
I completely agree with that. Recently, like, you know, I've been getting various sponsorship requests and like, it's crazy. Like, you know, this company, I'll charge them like this much and they're like, well, great. Other company, I'll charge them the same amount. They're like, we can't do that. And I'm like, wait, I'm like, am I getting my prices wrong? I'm like, you know, I don't even know what to calibrate on. I mean, I have a decent you know, subscriber count.
You have a good subscriber count, man. A good subscriber count.
You know, I have like views, engagement. Like engagement wise, my content is really good. Even, you know, having like a much more, smaller following. So it's like, sometimes it's like, you know, how do I calibrate on what to actually charge these brands for, like sponsorships or like integrations and reviews like that. So yeah, man, I think there definitely needs to be a little more knowledge out there, you know, for some of us who are just getting into this and trying to figure out this
definitely.
Whole thing.
And we may touch on that some more later on, but welcome back everybody to the Textual Talk podcast. Well, I'm your host HD and we got none other than Anakin Skywalker here with us today, AKA Day Cyberwalks, man. Day, what's up? Tell the people what's up, man.
Hey, not much, man. Thanks once again for having me. I feel like at this point, I'm probably your most, return guest on the channel, on the podcast. Maybe aside from Eric, though. I think he's been, you know, on much, much more than I have. But aside from Eric, like, I think I'm the most, like, you know, I'm the most popular return guest on your podcast and channel.
Yeah, I think this makes like the third episode that you've been on. So I don't know, but it's always fun. Me and him talk from time to time, and he's super busy. I'm busy, but anytime we get a chance to record, and so we do. Eric was busy today, so my guy was like, "Yeah, you know, I'm free at this certain time. We can shoot." So we're gonna get into it. Yes, matter of fact, let me wake y'all up real quick because it is Monday. Had to hit y'all with them gunshots, man. You know, I help y'all start y'all week off pretty good. One of the things that we see all the time on LinkedIn, TikTok, Twitter, any social media site, YouTube, we still have these debates about, you know, college for cybersecurity. Should you go? Whatever. And since you recently graduated from WGU, I wanted you to kind of give your recent expectation on going to school. Granted, your observation would be pretty unique because you're already working, but I still want you to kind of give your overview of it. He also has a video on like what he thought about WGU, but you can kind of briefly summarize that right now so we could kind of get a hand of it. And I might like rebuttal some things and maybe throw some things in there when you're talking about it.
Yeah. So basically like my general opinion of college in regards to getting to cybersecurity, mm-hmm. right? So I think that at a high level, I would say that you don't 100% need a college degree to get into cybersecurity, right? It's not a necessity, right? Just the same way, you know, you don't always need, like, there's specific things you just don't need, right? But it's not also to say that it's not helpful or it's not important. Now, I think my rule of thumb now that I'm, you know, I'm now graduated and I deal with a lot of people who are students and are just kind of like getting into the industry. My general rule of thumb and advice is if you're young, right, which is like between the ages of like 18 and 25, 26, you know, you don't have any responsibilities. You're not married. You don't have any kids. And, you know, you have the time, right? I don't think there's anything wrong in college. For some people, it's, you know, a good first major education experience to have. And also like for those who will, you know, do it on campus in person, it's good to have like, you know, that social aspect to it, right? You know, meet people and stuff like that. So I think at that high level, there's nothing wrong with it. But I think if you're going to go to college route, right, it should be approached with more caution and precision than people put into it, right? So I made an analogy on a recent video where I analyzed the top three colleges in the United States from my perspective. And I said that if you're going to buy a $100,000 car, right, you're not just going to like wake up one day, walk into the dealership and just pick up the car, right? Whether you have the money or not, except if you're really, really financially irresponsible. So if you're, you know, going to do that, you typically would like research the car, like, oh, I like this car, you know, let me see like what issues does he have, stuff like that, right? And just kind of learn more about the car. And then you research reputable dealerships, right, where this car is being sold, where you can buy this car, make sure like they have good reviews and stuff like that. And then, you know, save up your money, go there, and then purchase the car. In the same breath, in terms of college, right? College a lot of times costs like tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So in the same breath, you should first and foremost research the program you want to go to, which is the car in this case, right? Research the program, look at, you know, alumni, look at what people are saying about it, like if they learn anything from it. Then research the college itself, right? So the college in this case is the dealership, right? So research, you know, what are people saying about this college, right? You know, what's the cost and everything? And then decide if you want to put your money into that. I think a lot of people don't really put a lot of time, thought, and effort into researching these programs and these colleges and the results they have from these programs before actually putting their money down, right? And it's like the first biggest financial decision you ever make. So I think to sum it up, it's nothing wrong in going to college for cybersecurity, but I think that more effort and time and deliberation and conscious thinking should go into it before you put all of that money down, all of that time down into a college education, specifically for cybersecurity. So yeah, that's my opinion on
it. Yeah, dope, man. So would you say, and it might be hard for you to say this, because it's hard for us to say these things when we were already doing something, when we're going through school or not, right? For me, some of the sentiments that you just said are things I told my younger brothers when it came to them. Oh, I want to go to this school, that school. And I was like, why? Like, one of them is at my alma mater doing my major. And I was like, why are you? I wanted him to do community college just because it's cheaper and he would have got some certs from it. And then I would probably help him get an internship, which I'm trying to do now, but I need him to at least get this cloud practitioner. He needs something on his resume. But I was trying to convince my other brother, who's about to graduate from high school and go to college, that, oh, if you want to go to college, come to UNT. You'll be down the street from me. It'll be better than the options that you have at Northwestern. And I think one of the things that still cannot be replicated as much from maybe online learning is in-person in school, the connections and networks that you make, right? Is which what I tell a lot of young people, that that's what really school is really for. You're really paying for a networking experience. Yeah. So it's important to go to the right school so that you can make the right connections. Secondly, like you mentioned, the curriculum. I get people that hit me up all the time and say, hey, can you review this curriculum for this school? And sometimes I'm like, okay, cool. I'm looking at it. And then I'll say, okay, this looks good or this doesn't look good. And one of the reasons why we see less and less people go to school for cybersecurity is because that finding out that the curriculum didn't help them much to prepare for the real world. Whereas the boot camps seem to be more to be structured in a way that it can help you land something entry level. Whether or not it's going to be that first cybersecurity role, it may be an entry level IT role that you land and you worked on skills that you'll need to land a job. I think that's always the biggest thing that has been for me when it's come to recommending people to go to school or not. I've always said, okay, look at the curriculum, see if it comes with certs, see what type of classes you're taking, see if these classes resemble what are on job descriptions. If they don't, try to find a better program because you don't want to waste that time or money.
Yeah.
Like, and so, and while we're on this topic too, since you went to WGU, I have a friend that's been thinking about transitioning for a while now, and he was thinking about going to WGU, but he wants to do cloud stuff. And I said, although WGU is affordable, and this is just me based on some of the things that I've seen from the people I've seen to go to WGU, and you could, you know, rebut this. Although I feel like it's a good experience, I feel like some of the stuff that they have the people do for us, like some of the certifications and classes that they take, maybe aren't needed and could possibly have them just focusing on things that will not help them get better and what they really need to get in fast enough versus having them just focus on all the things that you would need to learn, like just to be in the cloud. Like, I don't see why a person that's going to go do a technical role needs to actually go take the Project Plus or something, like some of those classes I've seen people post from there. And I'm kind of like, why do they have you getting that? Like, I get it. Like, one time I didn't have to take a Project Plus class, but I did have to use Microsoft Project in my capstone. But it, you know, that was just, hey, something to use. I can see the benefit of that when you are developing something in a project and you're driving it from start to finish. That's a little bit different. But having me fixate however long it takes for me to learn this material and then go past the certification, I don't feel like it's conducive to me learning what I actually need to learn. Because that's really one of the other issues when it comes with college is, in my experience, it's been a quarter system. You spend 9-10 weeks learning all the stuff, and then by the time you get to the next quarter, you forgot what you learned. There's no continuity between what you learn in class to class. So that's the whole issue. Now, if they could do it like that, like how at least in grade school, the stuff that you learn, okay, we learned addition last month. Now next month works subtraction. Everything works together. If they structured it like that, I think it'll be much more successful in school alone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I kind of agree with, you know, your point on like learning things that are not necessarily relevant. the, like, for example, like the Project Plus, I thought it was just like, just completely unnecessary. But again, I think, you know, there are better, I think there are other, there are better ways to approach learning specific things, right? So Project Plus, of course, the goal of that is to understand project management, but I don't think the Project Plus was the best way to approach that. Maybe they could have done something like more project based, right? Where you are actually like going through the process of managing a project. Because now at work, right, I'm working on, basically leading some projects at work right now. And I think back to like, what I learned in Project Plus, and to be quite honest, there's not much I remember from it, right? At least stuff I remember, I try to, apply it with like managing like time and, multiple stakeholders, but there's not really much that I learned from it. But if I was in a situation where I had to kind of like actually practically manage a project, maybe like something like teamwork or something, like there's just better and, more innovative ways to could approach learning certain things, right? And I thought another thing to add to that in terms of, learning things, having a curriculum that is designed to be fast enough for you to be able to learn what you need to learn. I just think college is fundamentally not designed for that, right? College, whether it's WGU or, normal traditional college, is fundamentally designed to keep you there maybe as long as possible. So you just keep paying, right? And, bringing them revenue, because the faster you're able to leave school, that's less revenue for them. But if they keep you there longer, they're able to make more money from semester that you're paying for. So I think like that's sort of like a give and take with like what method of learning or approach you take into transitioning into cybersecurity. If you go to college, right, you have to kind of accept that you're going to have to learn things you have no interest in, and particularly don't have any sort of attribution to what you want to do. If you've got a bootcamp route, then you're taking a risk. It's a curriculum that's designed to help you get in as fast as possible, but how fast can you assimilate that information and stuff like that? So it's like, that's where weighing the pros and cons of your different options comes in, and knowing what level of risk you're willing to accept for either option that you have access
to. And speaking of bootcamps, I'm going to throw a shameless plug in here right now for springboard.com. I do have an affiliate link for them, but I'm glad you mentioned them. Well, boot camps in general. I mentioned the Springboard because I decided to affiliate with springboard.com because I overlooked the curriculum, the 10 courses that they're going to teach them. It's a 6-month long process. And I read some of the projects that they're going to do. So I thought that was cool. But what I also liked is saying, hey, after 6 months upon completing this boot camp, if you do not find a job, then we'll give you your money back. So that was a big thing to me because I've been on a tangent, you guys know, the last couple of episodes talking about some of these boot camps and some of the processes that they do preying on your ignorance because they know how bad you want to make that 6 figures. And that's how they get you. And you're going to be willing to pay whatever. If you're a person making $10, $15 an hour, and someone says, hey, you can go from working retail at Target to, being a 6-figure security analyst, just pay me $10,000, you're going to hop to it because, this person knows what they're talking about. I know I could do this. Not knowing that, like I said, unless those people you work with have relationships with companies that they put out good, polished professionals that they've hired at different places, it's going to be hard to establish that pipeline for them to guarantee you get some work. So that's why I say kind of just tread lightly and just also focus on things that shows you some skills that you'll know on a fundamental level when it comes to getting into cybersecurity. Because sometimes what you do find is because some people want to come in and just niche and they don't learn some of these foundational skills, they have, some problems with just regular computer stuff. And you have to think about that. Like a lot of people, what you will find that started in cybersecurity didn't start in cybersecurity. They did years of other stuff, and they'll look at you like, hey, why don't you know, this simple thing on how to do this on a computer? Like, how don't you know this? So those are one of those things. And this is not one of those conversations, but speaking of, it was something I actually wanted to segue into this next topic. Do you think, and this is hard, we talk about this a lot, but we can either say influencers or whatever we've seen, boot camps, anything. Do you think people are actually being realistic with cybersecurity salaries, especially for people? We're going to cover this for not people who have 3-4 years of other experience and they go entry or mid in cybersecurity. We're talking about straight entry level, your first role. Do you think people's expectations are unrealistic, or are the jobs just not wanting to pay them? They're just due.
I think people's expectations are unrealistic. And I say this as someone who right now, I feel like I am getting, like what I'm getting paid is pretty equivalent to the amount of work that I have to do, right? It's like when I was getting paid way less, the work I had to do was pretty equivalent. The amount of experience I had to have was equivalent to it. So I think a lot of times in the cybersecurity field, there's a very accurate correlation between your experience, your responsibilities, and what you're getting paid. And I think that there are a lot of the outliers are louder than the normal people, right? A lot of people who come out and be like, hey, I made 6 figures right out the gate, my first job, 6 figures, even like my first job, 90K. Those people are outliers. Those people are the exception, not the rule, but they are the loudest voices. So the mass, you know, typically just hears these loudest voices and they're the ones they follow and they base their expectations off of that. Truth be told, like, I think entry-level jobs, right, are, of course, I think there's definitely should be fairness in wages, but a lot of times entry-level jobs are you know, they pay in accordance to the responsibility and experience that you have. If you're going to be doing what I'm doing, then, of course, I wouldn't expect you to be, you know, earning anything less than 100K. Right. I mean, what I do requires a lot of, you know, good amount of experience, knowledge in several domains and really, really good, like, you know, technical and time management skills, because there's a lot of work and pressure that has to go into it. But even just the technical skills that is required, it's a lot. So I imagine that you get paid what I paid, what I get paid. But if you're not, if you're doing something else, like, you know, SOC roles are definitely important. But if you're like in a, you know, MSSP that, you know, is not even really like, they don't, they're just kind of toning up their environment. They're just kind of figuring stuff out. You know, the alerts are not even properly tuned. Like, they don't have a good sim. Like, even the alerts are not even high fidelity. Like, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if you're getting paid like, you know, like around, you know, 50, 60K. I don't think that's, I think it should be appreciative that you at least have a role to get experience. But if you're in a more like, you know, like a cyber fusion center that we worked in, where it's like, okay, there's a lot more moving pieces. You're working with a big client. There's a lot more at stake, right? You're dealing with real attacks. It requires more technical expertise. Then, of course, I imagine like you'd be getting paid way more. And again, it comes with the experience, right? People that are on I was probably the least experienced person on our team, but everyone else there, you know, had, you know, more years of experience than I did. And of course, I'm sure like their salaries aligned that. But you can't just, you know, come in with, you know, bare knowledge of like, you know, maybe blue team level one, try hack me here and there, maybe a boot camp or a college degree and think you can just like get a six-figure role, except you're extremely talented.
Like you.
Again, it's the exception, right? Not the rule, right? And not everyone is that person.
Yeah, definitely. I like to say, you know, RIP to the Godfather, we focus on the majority, not the minority. And these are the comments that I got. Like, I don't know if you follow me on TikTok, bro, but if you go look at that video I made with the Sec Plus background, and it's the white guy saying, "You sure about that? You sure about that?" And it's the title says, "I just got my Sec Plus. I'm ready for a SOC analyst job." And I put then the job description is pretty much saying, "You sure about that?" Right? I got so much like different flack for that, or people bringing in the minority of like, oh, government jobs. I was like, government jobs don't count. A lot of them are easy. There are some that are hard. Like, don't get me wrong. There are some that are hard, but a lot of them are easy. And a lot of them are hard to even get fired from. So they don't count. Anything outside of government, you're going to have to show your worth. That's pretty much what it boils down to. I tell people all the time, if you don't have a skill set, you'll be lucky to get, you know, 60, 65. Now, what I do, like, remember way back when you got your first start, I tried to say, see if there's who's going to give you the average. That's what I tell people. If they're going to hire you, try to get you the average. But if it's more than what you're making, it can pay your bills, take it, and let's use it as a paid internship.
Yeah.
That's the route. But a lot of people wouldn't have did what you did. They would have thought they could have got something better and possibly not got nothing at all. And that they don't understand. It's like, yes, it's tough. And I like the fact that you brought up when you talk about being in what type of environment, the stakes that play, your value to that company and that role, like how much money they could possibly lose if something happens. Those are important factors.
Yeah.
And which is why the last couple of weeks we've been talking about, instead of chasing companies, check out industries. different industries pay different things. Like I posted a couple of weeks ago, the Target C-Cert role that I was interviewing for last year, they popped back open. And, you know, that role, I think, was at least the base was like, what the range was up to 190 something, not including bonus. And I was telling people, look, Target was paying, you know, 200K plus, and that's just, you know, it's retail. I was like, you know, you go to finance, oil and gas, healthcare. There are many different industries, entertainment, that you can go into and work in and get money. That's how you can figure out what you're worth. But if you're just trying to, I've been seeing a lot of people doing spreadsheets. And also, one of the questions I kind of wanted to ask maybe on LinkedIn is about, I see a lot of these talent acquisition people having these issues. I'd apply 400 jobs and nothing. I don't understand how are you applying to so many jobs but not getting hit back. What is it off about your job search strategy or your resume that you are doing so horrible?
Yeah, I like say, sorry to cut you off. I like to say, like, with jobs, if you're applying to jobs and not getting hit back, there's a problem with your resume. If you're interviewing but not getting jobs, then you have problems with your interviewing skills. So depending on what problems you're facing, try to solve the problem from where it is from. So if you're not getting hit back, then fix your resume. If you're not getting offers, then fix your interviewing skills.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where I come in. It's funny because E is always the person that typically plugs me in, say, hey, get out my boy for all that. But I rarely actually like advertise as much as I should, but I can help with all those things. One of the simplest things you can do if you want to find out if your interview skills are good or not is record your interview. I promise you, you will find out so much about yourself. Like even my first Microsoft has this thing called the, it's not a gauntlet, but you do like four different interviews. I forget what it's called. But my first interview in that phase was a little shaky. And I might put the conceited is getting shaky, baby, right here. It was shaky. And I could tell, but the interviewer kind of walked me back off the cliff and helped me get comfortable and settle me down, which is, all right, guys, look, here it is. This is this veteran tech talk, whatever you want to call it, this segment right here, right? A lot of times we don't know a lot about companies when you're interviewing with them just because you're interviewing. You haven't worked with them. It's just like dating. You don't know much about the girl that you're on a date with, but you think you might like her. It says a lot about me when the people that I interview with take the time to make me feel welcome and we have generous conversations. That lets me know that's a team I want to work for. That's why high on my list to work with were Yahoo and Microsoft for sure, just based on interactions with the team alone and like the, especially with the director of Yahoo, super dope. Like one of the interviews, one of my interviewers, she watched my podcast episode and started our interview off with an icebreaker that I use in the podcast. So, right. That's so tough. It just was ways of just keeping me like welcome. Like I know what but back to like telling people to technically, I knew why I possibly got passed along. It's two things. One, I had been out of being technical for so long. I was kind of rusty. And two, I tried to leverage them. Once I got an offer, I tried to keep on saying, hey, I got this offer. You didn't make a decision when they weren't finished. I know for a fact that could have played a part in it too, because I don't like the wait around because it's hard playing a weight game. People's offers get rescinded. Yeah. It's like one of those things. So that's why I tell people, hey, don't put your 2 weeks in till you get your equipment. And look.
And with the economy
and look,
too.
Honestly, I'm like, look, wait, make it past the first 90 days first. Honestly, if you can, because it's like, it's tough. Now, for me, I had like 4 weeks when I put mine in and I was like, yeah, this ain't gonna work. I'm going to put these in for you, but that's pretty cool though. I like talking about interview stuff. I think I should probably talk about interviewing more. Like even I tell people, like for example, I don't know how you interview, but I typically always use my setup. So this is my recording setup. What I used to have it, I used to have it like it's my old setup. So it'd be just like this, pristine view, camera, nice sounding mic. Headphones, lights in the back. People like, oh man, that's cool. So it just would be a way, a little bit like psychology wise, of showing them like I'm taking it serious or whatever. Now I don't dress up like I used to back in the day, full suit, watch, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't really do that anymore.
Yeah,
I think it's a waste of time. I think the most you'll get out of me is a button down. Because when you get on that with the interview with them, they got on a tank top, a V neck,
Right. Hoodie.
So it's like, it's no point, man. We all know, and when it comes to tech, people rarely wear suits. Like, that's not what we have to do. That doesn't,
facts.
Unless you're going to like the stakeholders or some type of important thing, like, you really wouldn't matter.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. I definitely want to talk more about interviewing, but not quite yet. Like, I definitely have a couple of opinions and a lot of experience with interviewing. But you know, just not quite
yet. Yeah, and I actually want to ask you real quick about you, because really, so this is a question I have for you. It probably could segue from like maybe your interview experience early on and then to now, but like, how do you feel pretty much going into, this is going to make what, 3 years of your career now? Like going on year three?
Year three, okay.
So
September.
You know, I had the question for, I said, going into year three of your career, has your outlook changed, you know, about cybersecurity, your career? What things did you think about it beforehand that were totally different now that you're in it? And kind of how is that going for you being in year three? Because you are, now guys, he is the minority in this case. What he's doing doesn't normally happen. But like he said, and like I always say, I tell people all the time, your skills have to be exceptional. Like I've make jokes about, you know, you all the time saying like, if I'm talking to him most of the time, it's late at night, he's up studying or he's working on some type of project or something. It's similar to, I was telling him before we started that I watched the Javante Davis fight last night, similar to a boxer. We saw the guy who works on his skills knock out the guy who didn't work on his skills. Therefore, the other guy's more exceptional, elite than the other one, just on skill set alone. And that's how you have to view your skill set when you come into the interviews, right? I tell people how I landed a role was the fact that I was able to solve the problems that they kind of were dealing with. I already had answers for them. I had already seen them in the different environments. That's why it's easier to bring you on. If you've seen the stuff they're going through, you already know how to fix it. If you don't know how to do that, sometimes they may not go with you unless the team really likes you and feels like you won't be a person that just has to have your hand held throughout the entirety, like at the beginning of your tenure there. So tell us what your new outlook and perspective is, you know, on your career being almost 3 years in. Pretty much you are now really, I mean, by years wise, mid-level, but I still always say you have like senior level skills.
Yeah, honestly, I like that you actually asked that question because I've recently sort of been in like a pivotal stage in my career where I've really been thinking about a lot of things, right? Like a lot of things. And I think my perspective has changed a lot, right? On so many things. And there's so many things I'm still like rolling over in my head trying to like figure out where exactly do I stand on this. First thing is I say is like, you know, my opinion and like, how do I put this? It's not passion. Actually, it is passion, right? So when I first started in cybersecurity, my passion was for cybersecurity, right? You know, I wanted to get in cybersecurity because I had a passion for it. I still do. Like, I love cybersecurity. Like, I mean, like, nothing has changed about me. Always studying, always working on something new, learning new skills. That still, you know, is very important. And it's still a constant for me. But I think now as I'm growing older, and I'm not even that old yet, but as, you know, I've just maturing more responsibilities in life in general, I think passion kind of sort of takes a bit of a step back to more, what do I want to do in life overall? And I think cybersecurity could definitely be like a life goal. But I do think like cybersecurity is just a stepping stone to what I ultimately want to do in life in general. So I'm not as like when I first started, I was like, you know, all about cybersecurity, right? You know, all about, you know, just studying and, you know, but now I'm like really big on like, you know, building relationships, you know, connections with people around me, meeting new people and, you know, forming different things from these connections and relationships, right? But of course, still having cybersecurity as a major part of my life. So that's one thing that has changed, right? The passion is still there, but the passion is not generally geared towards, you know, as much as, you know, when I first, at first it was like, I need to get my foot in the door. And that was what my passion got me in. My passion now is like, okay, how do I get better at what I do, but also kind of sort of, slowly, you know, climb the ladder, right? You know, corporate wise and technical wise and skill wise, right? And I do have a, you know, big vision and goal for where I want to get to my career, which is I want to become a staff security engineer. So I'm actively working towards that, right? That's sort of like an ongoing thing. But now it's like my life has shifted more to other things, right? You know, being more concerned about family, about, you know, friendships and just like connections outside of cybersecurity in general. So that's been one thing that has changed about my outlook on cybersecurity. Another thing I would say is my outlook on compensation has changed as well. So getting in, I didn't really know much about like compensation in general, right? And again, I wasn't one of those people who was like, oh, I need to get a six-figure job. It just sort of happened. I got the right opportunities at the right time and everything kind of worked together that I was able to get that early in my career. But now it's like I sort of have career goals that are baseline against my skills and like, you know, how fast I'm improving or how much I'm getting better or new skills I'm learning. And I'm like, okay, with these skills, with this experience, with this level of knowledge, I think like this is realistically a good compensation range that you know aligns with those things, right? So that also kind of drives me to sort of I kind of baseline skills I want to learn against you know future compensation or compensation goals that I have. So that kind of drives me because I'm not like I want to make such amount of money. But I'm not doing anything to actively work towards it. I'm like, okay, I want to make this amount of money. So I'm going to learn these skills that are in high demand and are going to get me paid this amount of money, right? So those are the two major things that have changed about my outlook on cybersecurity since, you know, over the last three years.
Yeah, man, that's dope. Especially with, I would say, I'll start off with this before I forget it. But you being so young, being literally 10 years my junior, I would just tell you to keep on doing what you're doing now. And by the time you're my age, you're probably a made man, to be quite honest. Like, you're so far ahead of where I was at 21. It's ridiculous. At 21, I was finishing up undergrad and then went back to Target and worked retail. So I did that for a couple of months before I got my first help desk job, right? And I think and one of the things of why, like you said, what you find out what you want to do in your life, it's like, so different is one of the things is once I got in cyber and then, you know, there was nobody like you or me that we actually talked to, especially somebody you just reach out to online. I knew that when I started this 3 years ago, that this was something that I was going to probably be very passionate about. And those are the messages I always get when people say, yeah, I watch you one day, or, you know, remember we ran into people at Afrotech who knew who we were and who watched us for the last almost 3 years. Who got inspired by us and been able to get jobs from that. So like you said, of like kind of focus has changed. Like that's one of the things too. It's like, for me, I can still move up in my career, but my goal is actually one of the things is to be as skilled as possible and get paid as much to do as least work as possible now. And people will probably say, ah, man, this dude is crazy. But no, what I know is like most of the time, the higher you go up, if you're technical wise, most of the time, you're just fixing. You're not. Yeah. Look at this guy, busy man.
Sorry about that.
But most of the time, the higher you move up, and if you're not on the management track or you don't have like a real soft role, I mean, soft skills type of role where you have to do all these meetings, or even when you do have all the meetings, like that's probably the most you're doing, or just keeping things on tech. Like you might work a max 2 or 3 hours out the day. Especially like, you know, a lot of people, and this is the thing too, we've talked about this before, but, you know, people probably would think, you know, SOC roles are entry level, but in a sense they can be if it's just the MSS and you just sending stuff over. But as AI machine learning has increased and got more advanced, now they require more out of you at an entry level role than they did in the past. So that's why it's not necessarily just entry level. It's a little bit harder than it used to be. But when your eyes aren't on glass, and you're literally just the escalation point, and you may have to do a couple of meetings throughout the day, you might work 2, 3, 4 hours, but get paid $175,000, $200,000. You know what I'm saying? You can't beat that. But a lot of people will have not did what we did and try to go straight there. And that's the whole issue. You haven't worked to get there yet. No, go ahead.
I think it kind of ties into a story or like a parable I heard about a sword maker, right? He made a sword in like, you know, 3 hours, and he charged like $10,000 for the sword. And the person that he charged this money was like, hey, you only made this sword in like 3 hours. Why are you making me pay $10,000 for this sword?
.com has a great cybersecurity bootcamp that's for beginners and teaches you cybersecurity fundamentals and 10 core basic courses. The Springboard Bootcamp will show you how to use tools like Splunk, Wireshark, Kali Linux, Nmap, Metasploit, and much more. The bootcamp is 6 months long and has a total of 66 projects for you to complete before graduating from the program. Springboard believes in their program so much that if you do not find a role after 6 months of graduating, then they will give you your money back. Sign up now and use my discount code TEXTUAL to get $1,000 off your bootcamp price. The link will be in the description.
Well, he's like, well, you're not paying $10,000 for the 3 hours that I put into the sword. You're paying $10,000 for the 10,000 plus hours that I put into learning how to make this sword. So if you're not valuing me for the amount of time it takes me, because the amount of time it takes me now comes from all the hours that I've put in over these years to get really good at making this sword. So like, for example, yourself, them paying you like 180K, 200K plus to work 3-4 hours a day doesn't come from, you know, you doing 3 or 4 hours of work. It comes from you already having years, like decades at this point, of experience, right? And with that experience, like they're relying on your experience to make decisions and influence things that you're doing in the company security-wise.
Definitely. And I would actually like to touch on that parable with something that is a little bit more recent, and I've been trying to throw my themes into the show as well. For those of you who don't know, I'm a huge fan of Naruto. Naruto had a spinoff with his son Boruto, and the first movie is based on the part where Boruto's an extremely exceptional kid, and he didn't have the childhood like his father did or his mentor Sasuke did. They had it rough. They was fighting killers at a young age. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Boruto, so bored by everything, he gets enticed to get this scientific ninja tool where it could use all these chakras, energy. You could do all the different elements, earth, fire, wind, lightning. He could do all these different things and use it. But what happened was, when it came time to actually use it in the right way or actually needing to get out of something that that tool can help him with, he didn't know where to go to. And that's because lack of experience. Mm. Whereas his dad and Sasuke was fighting aliens and really beating them up fairly easy because they have the years of experience and that they put in to be at a level to know how to respond to everything. And like you said, yeah, when I was talking about solving problems in interviews, that is why, and I tell people all the time, once you get in the door, you're good. Learn what you can. If you're going to job hop, learn a lot of different skills when you job hop. Of course, I know you're doing it for money, but learn skills. Because now, once you got the expertise, when you're a decade in, 5 years in, whatever you want to call it, it's way easier. It's easier to get a job because they don't have enough mid and senior level, principal level people to approach for these jobs. Those are the real shortages. Entry level, everybody's trying to get in. When we get up here and you've already, they're looking for somebody. Oh, we want somebody with, what do you see on the job screen is enterprise-wide, cloud experience, writing cloud detections, or whatever like you do like in your role when you did it, like you're going on, what, 2 years of doing it now. It's going to be pretty simple for him to go to a company that has no type of cloud strategy whatsoever. It needs him just to be the foundation and build all that out. It's going to be hard a little bit in the beginning based on maybe, hey, what type of logs we have going in, or our connectors, or are we doing stuff through the SIM? Are we using a SOAR? What type of all these different logs? But outside of that, in the cloud, it's going to be cake for him. And he'll probably be doing his stuff in tasks, putting in Jira. Hey, it's done. I'm jumping on this meeting to tell you, hey, I did this. I'm talking to the SOC team. I'm talking to the DevOps team. I'm talking to the Intel team. Like, he's going to probably have these little meetings where it's like maybe 15, 30 minutes. And he'll be done. And that's probably a little bit of how his day goes now as far as like the stuff he's working on, because it's task-based. But I said all that mumbo-jumbo to say this, like, you cannot, like, fake the funk. You cannot, like, lie your way into getting to a higher position. I don't care what they're telling you on TikTok. It doesn't work in technical roles. Soft skill roles, you can kind of lie your way around it. But A technical role, no. You're messing up around long enough, they're going to put you on a PIP and they're going to fire you. And that's one of the things they don't tell them is, oh, yeah, just, you know, we told you last week how LinkedIn is about to start verifying employment on LinkedIn. So you can't just make up companies and say you work there. On top of, even if you try, even if you get through the interview and the screening on the back end, when they try to resolve where you work, that that strategy will not work. So it's best not to lie. But if you got the skill set and they like you good enough, you got a chance to get in there. Especially the key thing is networking, too. If you can network with a person that's on that team, and that person is an exceptional person on that team and not just the guy, you got a big chance to get hired at that team. Because if that person says you're good, you're good. Anything you want to add to that?
Facts. No. I think networking piece is a huge part of it. Like, that's definitely been really helpful for me in my career. Right, it's gotten me so many opportunities that I wouldn't even dream of, right? You know, I got my Optiv role through you, right? You referred me for that one. I mean, you didn't interview me, but like, just your prestige and your level, like saying, oh, I know this guy, like this guy's good, was good enough for them to want to interview me, right? Same with, like, you know, other roles I've gotten, even like my role at Datadog. It's like, you know, it's social proof, right? Someone's like, oh, that's my guy. Like, I know this guy. Like, it's like, that's how people like become friends with other friends. It's like, oh yeah, this is my dude. Like, oh, if he's friends with this dude, then he's cool, dude, right? So same thing. If like, oh, if Honre says this guy's good, of course, let's interview him. Let's see what he's about, right? So networking is a huge piece, but networking also comes from showing your work, right? There's no way you would have known that I was good, or, you know, you would have been, there's no way you would have been confident, because you don't want to put your name behind someone you can't really validate their skills. So there's no way you could have been like, oh, Day is good, without actually seeing my work. Like, obviously not what I know. Like, so it comes from showing your work, showing your worth, and people are more inclined to be associated with you and want to put their names behind you. Because if you come in and you're killing it, bro, that's an accolade to you that referred them. It's like, oh man, this dude that Henri told us about, he's solid. He's a cool dude, right? So that's also a huge part of it as
well.
Yeah,
man, that's me for sure. Like, I do not put my name on people that I've never worked with or I don't have a good relationship with. If I don't see you putting in the work, I'm not going to put my name on it, because it's going to make me look bad. I have good track records of referring people. If you see I work somewhere, I'm not going to just refer you just because you see I work there. No, that's not the best way. Talk to me first. Maybe try to buy me a coffee, no pun intended, and see where it goes from there. Like, don't just try to reach out to me and you don't know me to get a favor from me. No, that's not how it works. Now, it's different when you're you apply to a job and you're reaching out to a recruiter. That's totally different. But to try to get a referral, yeah, no. It's easy ways to get a referral to doing that. Now, some people just refer people because they're hoping you're good enough and they're going to get that good money that comes with it. But that doesn't always work. But I had two articles that I wanted to review briefly real quick. I think the first one we want to talk about is this, the Twitter legacy. So it says Twitter appears to have officially killed off its legacy blue check marks, one of the last remaining vestiges of the pre-Elon Musk era. The legacy blue checks, which Twitter doled out to journalists, celebrities, and other public officials for free to help curb impersonations and spam, were supposed to end April 1st. And I never got one. I'm just saying. Musk took to Twitter on April 11th, days after the legacy check mark should have disappeared, to shift the end date to April 20th or 420. Yes, that's the day when folks unread, because Twitter is now owned by a middle schooler. That's funny. With legacy checks gone, Twitter will have verification marks only for paid users and businesses, as well as government entities and officials. Now, if a user sees a blue check mark and clicks on the label, it reads, "This account is verified because they are subscribed to Twitter Blue and verified their phone number." Some users, including TechCrunch reporters, experienced Thursday a flickering blue check mark on their profiles. Others have seen their blue check marks disappear altogether. Under Musk's rule, Twitter hasn't held back on his promise to remove the legacy check marks from even the highest of profile figures. Even Pope Francis couldn't escape the great unchecking of 420. I think that's pretty interesting. Because I see now, and I don't know if you've ran into this yet, but it's not on Twitter, but on Instagram, I had a fake page made of me. Like, somebody act like they were me. Yeah, man. Really?
Was it verified?
No, it wasn't verified. It was just a page.
Okay.
And they had a similar name. They had an underscore in it. They had my link that I have and my description in it. And they had took some of the posts and just act like they were me. I was like, no, it's not me. Like, because people were saying, is this you? No, it's not me.
That's crazy.
And I got people reported. So I don't know if that page is still up. But that's the reason why I would pay for verification. For me, it wouldn't be because I want to feel important. It's more so to try to just protect the people that follow me and listen to me from listening to a fake me acting like they're me, you know? And think about this now going on, and this is how scary this can get now, where I think they need to revisit verification. Last week, Eric and I talked about AI Drake in The Weeknd. I don't know if you heard the track.
Mm-hmm. That joint was fire.
It was fire. But so also check this out. It's like, let's say, for instance, someone made a fake Day Cyberwalks page, and they also did, like, Twitter has these voice memo things, so they have AI to copy your voice, and now they're acting like they're you, because there's no verification, you know?
Yeah.
Those are going to be the things that they're going to have to figure out on what they want to do with this, because everybody, we don't mind paying for, but why do we need to? Someone else shouldn't be able to, I think... And it may be hard. It had to be a different way, but maybe in a way, it's just like, okay, if your name is Day Cyberwalks, someone can't create another name with Day Cyberwalks underscore two and all this, and that they have to provide valid information that they are the originator of Day Cyberwalks. And so maybe it's you creating another page for yourself, a backup page, but no one else should be able to use those letters to make a name. I think that's the way that they need to try to do that. What you think?
I think, you know, it's easy for us to have opinions on things when we don't see that scale, right? Twitter is dealing with millions or hundreds of millions of customers, and certain things are not a one-size-fit-all solution. Now, I personally have a, you know, different opinion of Twitter and Elon Musk, at least his approach to Twitter, than most other people. I actually like that Twitter is actually, he at least, if even if it's just people paying for verification, that's one way to drive revenue and profitability for Twitter. And I appreciate that. I think from a profitability investment standpoint, it's a good thing. Like, Twitter is actually generating revenue from, you know, something that makes sense. And if it's your business, a business of your own, you have every right to define how you want to be profitable from that business. And if it means people have to pay to verify that, you know, they are actual owners, especially if we're talking about high profile celebrities, right? You know, people who are very well to do, very popular people, government officials, you know, sports people, entertainment, actors, whatever it is. I don't personally think anyone in that caliber should be complaining about having to pay for verification. That's my personal opinion. Now, overall, when it comes to like people in general, like, you know, maybe people like us who have a pretty decent following, right? But there's also like the risk of people impersonating us. I feel like there could be other solutions where maybe you don't have to pay for it. Of course, I can't say the people with more money should pay for it, and people, you know, with less money shouldn't pay for it. But I just think, like, I personally don't see it as a problem. I like, once again, I like the approach to profitability, and I also, you know, I think like, if you truly care about, you know, your account being the, you know, single account where no one can impersonate it, then by all means, go ahead and pay for, you know, the Twitter Blue. Now, for other things that Elon might do or things that Twitter might support, I don't stand for. But from my perspective, I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, man, it's just a real yeah,
weird.
It's just a weird time with social media right now. Matter of fact, are you on Blue Sky? Yeah, Jack Dorsey, the old owner of Twitter, has started up or backed another social media site. It looks just like Twitter. It's called Blue Sky. Let me see. Matter of fact, I can show it to you right now.
Oh, what the heck? That literally looks like Twitter. That looks like an actual Twitter clone.
But But I was also going to say the sucky thing that used to be in the past, the issue with verification was like there was no minimum follower amount needed to be verified. So no one knew what it took to be verified back in the day either. It's like, what's considered popular? What's considered a public person? You know, that was the hard part. It was hard to get in touch with those people, you name it. And we have another article that I want to briefly get into really quickly. Here it is. Let me know when you can see it. Decoy dog malware toolkit found after analyzing 70 billion DNS queries. A new enterprise targeting malware toolkit called Decoy Dog has been discovered after inspecting anomalous DNS traffic that is distinctive from regular internet activity. I'm not going to get a dictionary out, guys, but in security, we do use terms like anomaly. Like we had the team anomaly and detection, and I'm going to say for layman's terms, anomaly means suspicious, different type of activity on your network. It's a good term to throw out in an interview. Just a heads up. Decoy Dog helps threat actors evade standard detection methods through strategic domain aging and DNS querying, dribbling, aiming to establish a good reputation with security vendors before switching to facilitating cybercrime operations. I wonder, is this similar to the domain fronting stuff or the SEO joint that Intel was telling us about? It's where they'll buy a domain, make it look good, get a whole bunch of traffic going to the domain, and then switch it to make it malicious and attack people and start sending them spam stuff.
sounds like it is similar.
Researchers from Infoblox discovered the toolkit in early April 2023 as part of its analysis of over 70 billion DNS records daily to look for signs of abnormal or suspicious activity. Infoblox reports that Decoy Dog's DNS fingerprint is extremely rare and unique among the 370 million active domains on the internet, making it easier to identify and track. Hence, the investigation into Decoy Dog's infrastructure quickly led to the discovery of several C2 command and control domains that were linked to the same operation, with most communications from these servers originating from hosts in Russia. Yeah, most time you see C2 traffic is, that thing may be infected. Maybe. Keyword is maybe. Doesn't always mean it is, but maybe. Further investigation revealed that DNS tunnels on these domains had characteristics that pointed to, I don't know how to say that. Is that Pupy Rat? P-U-P-Y Rat?
Let's say Poppy Rat.
A remote access Trojan deployed by the Decoy Dog Toolkit. Pupy Rat is a modular open source post exploitation toolkit popular among state sponsored threat actors for being stealthy, which means it's fileless, supporting encrypted C2 communications, and helping them blend their activities with the other users of the tool. The Pupy Rat project supports payloads in all major operating systems, including Windows, macOS, Linux, and Android. Dang, anybody can get it. Like other rats, it allows threat actors to execute commands remotely, elevate privileges, steal credentials, and spread laterally through a network. Less skilled actors do not use Pupy Rat, as deploying the tool with the correct DNS server configuration for C2 communications requires knowledge and expertise. This multiple-part DNS signature gave a strong confidence that the correlated domains were not only using Pupy, but they were all part of Decoy Dog, a large single toolkit that deployed Pupy in a very specific manner on enterprise or large organizational non-consumer devices. Infoblox revealed in its report. Furthermore, the analysts discovered a distinct DNS beaconing behavior on all Decoy Dog domains that are configured to follow a particular pattern of periodic but infrequent DNS request generation. Investigations of the hosting and domain registration details revealed that Decoy Dog operation had been underway since early April 2022. Wow, so about a year. Despite the toolkit's domain showing extreme outliers in analytics. And guys, this is like the fun stuff. When I always tell people about cyber threat intel, these are things that threat intel gets and they typically brief your team on, or they'll do a write-up and send it out company-wide so you could be aware of this stuff. So if you like investigating cyber crimes and wanting to help all the different cyber strategy teams come up with solutions to help them stay safe in their likeness not being taken advantage of over the internet, like look into cyber threat intelligence. It's actually, I'll probably say it's one of the fastest growing type of, what you consider like a domain, like a cybersecurity. Like you see how many different cyber threat intel roles you see now actually for very like good pay.
Yeah. I think threat intel is definitely like it's like a sort of an under the radar sort of role. People don't really tap into or know much about, but it's definitely like super niche, and like you definitely pick it a lot. Like especially if you're working like in big tech or even like enterprise, like, you know, companies like Target or like Walmart, industries where like they have very specific sort of like attacks against them or like threat actors against them, threat intel could definitely be a huge part of their cybersecurity strategy.
Yep. The discovery of Decoy Dog demonstrates the power of using large-scale data analytics to detect anomalous activity in the vastness of the internet. Infoblox has listed Decoy Dog's domains in its report and added them to its suspicious domains list to help defenders, security analysts, and targeted organizations protect against this sophisticated threat, explains the Infoblox researchers. Discovery of Decoy Dog, and most importantly, the fact that several seemingly unrelated domains were using the same rare toolkit, was a result of this combination of automatic and human processes. Because the situation is complex and we have been focused on the DNS aspects of the discovery, we expect more details to come from the industry in addition to ourselves in the future. The company has also shared indicators of compromise on its public GitHub repository, which can be used for manual addition into the block list. That's pretty cool. I thought that was a pretty interesting article since it came up like over like last week. And it just shows, like, I always try to tell the guys when they want to, when we're doing like either some SOC training or they're trying to answer my questions and I'm giving them advice on it. I was like, when it comes to analyzing, you are looking for patterns. Like patterns and trend analysis is like going to be key when it comes to anything. That'll let you know this just isn't, you know, a mistake. You might see something like every Tuesday at 2 p.m. this command was ran or whatever. You kind of just start piecing the puzzle together and seeing what happened. Like that's what you're actually looking for. Things out of the ordinary, but that seem to happen over and over again. That's what I would attribute to. What you think?
Yeah, I think it. I you know, it's a sort of it's interesting. I want to say that actually I like it. But I you know, from a good perspective, in the sense that I think it's showing that attackers are getting more and more advanced. They're getting more and more, you know, niche with their toolkits and with their attack vectors. For example, this thing has been going on since April of last year, and it's just really not getting attention now. I think as we see attackers getting more and more, you know, innovative with their approach, it puts us defenders on our toes. It pushes us to be better at what we do because we know people out there are smart and they're putting a lot of work and effort into what they're doing. So we can't afford to just be lazy and not kind of keep up with what they're doing. And also, it also goes to show like, Think about the attack technique of, you know, first of all, making a site to be reputable and seem to be a good, you know, site or whatever, right? And then making it trusted and then, you know, sort of like pulling the rug and being like, nope, selling it to cyber criminals, and using it for all sort of nefarious stuff. That goes to show like they're also not just like technically smart, they're also strategically smart as well. Like they have a little strategy, like in the way they approach like cybercrime and malicious activity. So apart from being technically sound in cybersecurity, you also have to think strategically, because the people you're dealing with, they're not dumb. They're smart individuals. Of course, you have like, you know, script kiddie level people, but if you're dealing with more advanced and more nation state people, like they know you're working towards detecting them and they're doing things to prevent that from happening. I was actually having a conversation with Troy, who's a offensive security engineer / red teamer. And he was talking about, you know, he's working on, you know, becoming better at like, you know, he knows the defenders have detections in place. How does he like bypass EDR detection? All those things, right? So the defender, I think that's another thing I'm working on is like, how do I consider these different things attackers are doing, right? Attackers, they're smart. They're getting smarter, right? So I know they're doing things to bypass my detections. How do I factor in their considerations into my detections and make sure I have enough coverage for other possibilities that I might not be thinking of at a high level? So I think that's my takeaway from it. It's like we're, as defenders, we also have to start being more strategic and innovative in the way we approach solving problems from a defensive point of view.
Definitely. I agree with all that because things are always changing. And one of the things we've been talking about all the time is common sense. Or when it comes to social engineering, just playing on your mindset. Like I had a thing that said, hey, you know, click this if you want to keep the same password.
And it was a phishing test. I didn't click it because I was like, first of all, the date you're saying my thing expires is not what AD is telling me when my password expires. So that was the red flag. Then I looked at the site. I said, I don't recognize that site. It's not really a part of our company's domain. And so I reported it. And it, as phishing, it said, congratulations, you passed the simulation. But the fact that people hate making passwords is a way, the easy way for people to click it and get caught. Yep. Like, it's crazy. And like you said, I do a lot more phishing analysis than I used to. So I get to go in and actually look at these things, either detonating, what they're actually going to, how, you know, are these legitimate companies? Do we have, like, some of the, so here's the thing too, what people don't know is on this is on the other end, right? A lot of the breaches sometimes happen from third party. So sometimes it's not, let's say for instance, you could be talking to somebody every day for work that you work with a company wise, and then that company gets exposed. And so now attackers in there talking to you as if they're them, and that's how they get your information. It's a scary thing. So you have to always be vigilant. That's why IR, they get paid bigger bucks, because that's what they come in to do. I had one more thing. I think I saw on TikTok. It was funny. It was the top five entry-level cybersecurity certifications. However, when you look at the certs, that they really aren't entry-level. Let me see if it'll...
Got to see that a lot.
Top five cybersecurity entry-level certifications. Comsha Security Plus. Certified Ethical Hacker. GIAC Security Essentials. System Security Certified Practitioner. Offensive Security Certified Professional. Top 5
Cyber... What do you think about that OSCP being in the end?
I don't think it's a entry-level certification. I've actually been thinking about it recently. I've been thinking, like, you know, I actually eventually want to take the OSCP, but I think... I think that's sort of the problem, right? Like, calibration in the industry is so weird to do now, because you have, like, you know, dudes with, like, no experience at all, right? You know, maybe just like in college or just coming out of college or just very new to cybersecurity, coming in, doing OSCP in 6 months and passing. People, like, just think it's an entry level certification. It comes back to the point of, they're the exception, not the right rule, right? And the exception is always the loudest, right? I mean, Security Plus is entry level, I would say. CEH is entry level.
SSCP, yeah, I feel about CEH.
Maybe. I know. We all feel the same about
CEH.
I would definitely.
Because here's the thing is, like, if you're going to put CEH up there, then they should do one or two things. Put the it used to be called the ECIR. I don't know what it's called now, but either like EJPT, and now those are more entry level than you actually talking about, you know, CEH, which is like a waste of money. It's like $600. If you're gonna get CEH, you might as well get CYSA plus, if that's the case. Because I only say that because that come from like I don't talk about the government much, but that will be one that's on the same level as that government, whatever that scale is, that you need to get certain like jobs. So I would say that over CEH.
Yeah.
But normally it really be blue team level one, maybe. I haven't tried out. Have you did Cyber Defenders yet? I reached out to that guy. He's supposed to.
I'm
not talk about it.
I'm like 60. I'm like 70.
How is it? Because I want to review it as well. Okay.
It's great. It's really good.
Okay.
It's really good. It's like same level as B team level. Nice. Blue team level
I think
one.
I'm gonna do it, but I know I need to go ahead and get through with this AWS security specialty first. If not, then I will never finish it. And this is only done because you know, just need to do it like work wise. I only do certs that's gonna help me get better at what I do. I think that's the key with it. Like, why go do something that you're not gonna be able to implement on a day to day basis? Like, though I would like, I think I will eventually get to where I like learn some basic red team stuff. But I want to be able to do red team stuff and not just sit on it and not be able to do it. I mean, of course, I could do it on my own lab or something that I make, but nothing replicates real world experience. Nothing.
Facts.
Nothing does.
Facts. But I do want to like kind of touch on something about that TikTok. I think that's there's a problem with going to keep running into with short form content. when you talk about specific things without context, it could be so much attribution to it, right? If you're saying this is the right way to do something, but you don't have any context into it, then it could be wrong, right? Saying something that you could be fundamentally right about something, but without context, it could be wrong, right? It's like you could be saying the truth, but without context of it, right? It could sound a type of way. So I think that's another problem with short form content. I don't, to some extent, I don't disagree with him saying the OSCP is an entry level certification. For offensive security, it is an entry level certification because there are way higher ones than that. But if you're saying to get into cybersecurity, this is an entry level certification, there's a lot of things wrong with that.
That's what I felt about it.
So that's why context is important.
I don't think you could just, well, there are a minority of people that can just pick it up and pass it, right? But everybody's not.
Right.
The information in it is too deep. You might need to do a pen test plus, maybe, before that.
Or like a PMPT or EJPT. Right.
PNT, that's the TCM one, right? Yeah, and I would probably advise anybody to do the TCM one first anyway, simply because it's going to give you that realistic feel. And no, I don't have an affiliate link with them, but if y'all watching this, y'all need to give me one. But it's going to give them that realistic feel of passing the test and then having to write the report on what you found in your penetration test. That's the whole part that everybody don't get. That one part is cool, but then the report, because they're paying you for the report. All the vulnerabilities that you found when you were inside the network. That's what they want. They can care less about what you did. They want to fix this stuff. So you have to know how to articulate that and present it in a manner that the other people can understand, that it's just technical enough where they know it's important, but also that they understand like how much money it's going to cost. Got to include the money cost. What this cost? What would you propose will be fixed based on so criticality scale, all these different things, all these factors. That's what matters when it comes to doing a penetration test. No, I'm not a red teamer, but trust me, we see the reports all the time. But yeah, man, you got any other words for the viewer seeing like you are like newly, like this dude hadn't been when did you turn 21 again?
February.
Yeah, man,
so
he's
like 2 months
newly
ago.
Legal. Matter of fact, I should ask you this for a icebreaker. What was the first thing you did when you turned 21?
What was the first thing I did when I turned 21? I mean, like,
I don't know, I know, like, the good things. Okay, so here's it goes, like, getting older. It's like, 18, woohoo, I could buy tobacco. 21, oh, I can do everything. So, like, because normally, well, sometimes, depending on where you're at, if you look older, they may not card you. So I don't know how often you were used to getting carded or not. I know back home, they ain't card that much.
Well, I wasn't going out as much, so I didn't have to get – the only time I ever got carded was, like, if I, like, went for, like, a work trip or –
you didn't get carded with us,
you know,
at PF Chang's. I don't think.
I mean, PF Chang's is like a restaurant, though. So, I mean, again, though, that kind of makes sense, though. But I mean, like for me, like I didn't really do anything. Like I didn't, like I didn't, like I never really was big in drinking. So I didn't even, like, I could go walk into any liquor store and buy, you know, something, but I don't even have the affinity for it. So I didn't even, you know. I haven't done that since I only like maybe if I hang out with people and they're like,
yeah, so you're a social drinker.
Take a shot or something.
Yeah.
Even like socially, like you have to like really, really pressure me for like me to like.
Yeah, I would never pressure anybody. Like they, okay, cool, what you want. But normally people just get like something.
Not like pressure, just like, are you sure? You know, like type stuff. Nah, yeah.
I know what you mean. I know like for me, as I got older, I probably became more of a. A normal, like I have a little bar thing over there. Granted, there's nothing on it right now, but like, you know, I got to the age where I drink a lot of my stuff straight now. Like, like you see in the movies, where people just drinking it straight after a long day of work, you need to kind of just calm down. But I definitely feel you on that. But that should have been the first thing I would ask you. It would have been funny. I would have started this. This episode off. Let me see the Drake song when he's talking about 21. Can you do something for me? Because you're 21. I was gonna be funny saying that. But nah, I'm actually going to see him in June, so that's gonna be dope. Me and my girl going to see Drake. So
yeah, I know you like Drake. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how old you was, but I've been listening to him since I was like 15. So it's been like half my life I've been listening to Drake. Then my face like five.
That's a long
bro.
Time.
That's crazy.
how old is Drake right now?
Drake's like, if I'm 31, Drake is like 36, and he should be like 37 at the end of the year.
Yeah, crazy.
Man, I was one of the original people watching him on Degrassi, man. But appreciate everybody for tuning in. Like we always say, you can't get past if you can't get past us if you don't put in the work. But if you have any questions about anything, you know how to reach out to me. You know how to reach out to Day. He has a lot of helpful content on his page. Like Day is really the young Josh Metalcore. I don't even know how Josh consistently puts out his thing content as he does. Listen, guys, I'm telling you, I'm actively working on getting Josh on here. I reached out to him a couple of times, but I do want to get him on it because I do think he's like a phenomenal instructor, even from his YouTube site. It's pretty good. And I heard he has a new security course. I don't know if it's through Course Careers or Leveled Career. So I definitely would want to talk to him about that because I'm always pushing for that. But also, guys, if you're ready to get started in cybersecurity, click the link in my bio for Springboard Cybersecurity Bootcamp. 6-month guarantee of getting your money back if you don't pass the class. Well, no, if you don't find a job after passing the course, they give you your money back. So a win is a win, right? But you want to leave them with anything, Day? You want to tell them anything?
You know, I just same thing I would say, like just put in the work, network, all of that. And I think just apply what you hear. I think a lot of things that we've said is like so repetitive. We say the same things over and over and over again. People still ask us the same questions. I think if you would just take the time to listen, and actually apply what you're hearing, like you'd be way, you know, farther ahead than you're currently at right now. So that'd be my 2 cents.
Yeah, man. Like I told y'all last time, stay ahead of the game. We'll be back next Monday. It's your boy HD, and I'm out. Peace.